Welcome to 5-Minute Journal Club, Oral SIRS Edition. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. On our last program, we met with Dr. Kamal Jhaveri from Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, the principal investigator of the Phase 3 EMBER-3 trial she presented at the December San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, and it was simultaneously published in the New England Journal. To follow up her review of the landmark data set, I also asked her about the discussion of her paper by Dana-Farber's Dr. Hal Burstein, who not only commented on EMBER-3, but a number of other critical issues in oral SERD treatment. Dr. Burstein, in his usual inimitable, mirthful manner, apologized, but not really, for putting up a slide where he demonstrated indirect comparison of the progression-free survival from a number of trials in the second-line endocrine setting, and why the EMBER-3 imlunestrant and abemaciclib arm was very different.
When I looked at the data for the first time, I was like, wow, we have for the first time crossed that six-month mark in the second-line setting. Because so far, when we looked at all the data sets, whether it's biomarker or not biomarker, it was under 6 months, nothing over 6 months. And we really were hoping that someday we will be able to break that. And when we saw the 9.4 months and in the pre-CDK4/6 inhibitor pretreated patients, which is again 65% that got the doublet 9.1 months, I felt like finally we're able to achieve something which looks better. Again, no head-to-head comparisons. It's not like we've compared, say, capivasertib with this combination, but at least what we have is what we have. The data are the data, and these numbers are in fact attractive. I think the biggest question that people want to, you know, get addressed is, should we be using the combination if it's available only in ESR1 mutant tumors, or should we be using it for all patients? I think at the end of the day, I think about this as, you know, this is an all oral targeted regimen. It does have the data from EMBER-3 of showing low toxicity rates. In fact, even lower than fulvestrant abema that was reported in Monarch 2, probably just a reflection of how well we can now handle diarrhea for our patients, maybe. But no new safety signals, thankfully, right? And so I think it's an all-oral option. It's safe, very low discontinuation rates. It really makes it easy for those docs who don't have access for, say, NGS testing in a timely way, and they don't have to necessarily rely on checking for these alterations and can offer this therapy. And I think if a patient chooses to take this and has access or a means to be able to do it, and there is ease for the practice to be able to offer this without waiting for it, I do think it's a good option. And I think it's good to have many options.
Let me ask you your thoughts about a couple of other issues that came up with Dr. Burstein's discussion. First, the relative tolerability of various oral SERDs, which he went over.
We've not necessarily truly understood the true pathophysiologic mechanism for these. I mean, you know, if you look at a CERAN, such as palazestrant in the OPERA-1 trial, they have neutropenia. Go figure. Why would you have an endocrine agent cause neutropenia? So, you know, there are some nuances to this. We did not see the bradycardia and the phototoxia in the imlunestrant program, maybe in the EMBER study, which is the phase 1 trial that is published in the JCO this year, and or last year, I should say now, or the EMBER-3 trial. We did see some bradycardia with giredestrant. We've seen some bradycardia phototoxia with camizestrant. We're not seeing bradycardia phototoxia with elacestrant. But I've been fortunate, Neil, to be working on all of these agents in clinic with my patients to get a qualitative feel of what this means and what this toxicity could mean. And I'd love to share that for sure, that yes, I have seen some bradycardia and yes, I've seen some phototoxia. Fortunately, they have been very low grade and not necessarily clinically that disruptive or detrimental to patients. They bring in that logistical impedance in that, you know, you have to plan for an EKG or you have to plan for a, you know, eye assessment with an ophthalmologist. But thankfully, they're not higher grades and thankfully, they're not being disruptive. So that's the good news about it. But they are there and some drugs have it and some don't. And we don't necessarily understand why this is happening very easily.
So another thing I noticed from Dr. Burstein's presentation that I really wasn't aware of was the issue of hypertriglyceridemia with elacestrant. How much of an issue is that? Do you have to treat it?
Yeah, so it's very interesting. It actually made it to the package insert as well, and they actually recommend doing lipid monitoring before you start a patient, and then occasionally during that. I've had one patient where the cholesterol levels really shot up, and I actually had to dose reduce for the first time. So I've never had to dose reduce for nausea with LSS-Tren, but I did have to dose reduce this one patient for their cholesterol levels and triglyceride levels. And so that is something that is there, 30% hypercholesterolemia, 27% hypertriglyceridemia, not completely trivial, something that we want to keep an eye on in early stage, right? Because these patients are going to stay on this therapy for a longer period of time. So something we want to keep an eye on. Numerically, the Imlunestrant numbers in EMBER-3 were lower. So again, we don't have head-to-head comparisons, but numerically, they were much lower with the levels of hypercholesterolemia and the triglyceridemia that we saw in EMBER-3 with Imlunestrant. So something we have to keep an eye on in early stage for sure.
Here's another part of Hal's talk, the issue of CNS penetration of oral SERDs and the anti-tumor activity of SERDs in the CNS.
Preclinically, Imlunestrant has shown both CNS penetrance and CNS activity. So it's a brain-penetrant oral SERD, similar to LSS-Trent, which is also thought to be brain-penetrant. And there is an ongoing study for LSS-Trent also in patients with brain metastases. But because we knew this preclinical information, we performed a post hoc exploratory analysis to really look at the cumulative incidence of CNS progression in these patients. And surely enough, there was a trend towards benefit from Imlunestrant. When we looked at it, the ESR1 mutant tumors, it was 2% compared to 7%. Again, we're talking very small numbers here. So these hazard ratios really have to be taken with a grain of salt. But what I can say is that this is a first proof of concept in clinic, which gives us some encouragement and some more reassurance that what we saw preclinically is translating into clinic in those 15 patients where we tracked with brain metastases or CNS progression rates in the EMBER-3 trial. And hopefully with the addition of abemaciclib, which also has CNS activity, maybe we will have an impact for patients with ER-positive tumors that also have brain metastases. And this can cross the blood-brain barrier and hopefully derive benefit in such cases.
Another paper from the San Antonio meeting that I asked Dr. Jhaveri about was a, quote, real-world study of the use of the approved oral SERD, elacestrant. And of great interest, the data, including time to next treatment, seemed to closely match what was seen in the EMERALD-3 phase 3 trial, which Dr. Jhaveri found very relevant and meaningful.
It's beautiful when you see these real-world results and they're complementary to the clinical trial. That gives you the reassurance, right? That when you really apply this to the masses, we're still seeing the same benefit. It's confusing and you don't know what to do with them if they are discordant from the trial results. For example, with the palbociclib overall survival data, when we looked at the real-world data with first-line palbociclib, we did not see that in the clinical trial, but we saw that in real-world analyses. And we were like, should real-world trump the trial data? Should we still not be utilizing them? So they can be confusing. I think they're very complementary. I think it gives us confidence that while we have some selection bias or, you know, we think that a certain group of patients are the ones that get access to these clinical trials, because if you think about it, trials are still 5 to 10% of the patient population. So is this generalizable? Is this a treatment pattern that you would expect in the community? Is this the same kind of patient population that you would expect in the community? Some of the work that you are doing is really appealing because of that. You know, what are the treatment patterns that you see really happening when you have a drug approved or when you have data available? This gives you that confidence. It was really nice and reassuring to see that these data mimicked what we saw with the EMERALD trial, and this is how these drugs can be utilized.
At Research to Practice, we love trials in progress posters that now are an important part of many oncology research meetings. And I asked Dr. Jhaveri about one from the San Antonio Breast Cancer Symposium, focusing on the so-called ELSIN study, evaluating elacestrant in the CDK-naive metastatic setting, along with a number of other recent papers focusing on important ongoing clinical trials of oral SERDs, including in the adjuvant setting.
One thing that the elacestrant program is trying to do is with the ELSIN trial. What's the ELSIN trial? ELSIN trial is really an ongoing phase 2 study, which is focusing on CDK4/6 naive patients. So currently our label for elacestrant is specifically for tumors that have already been exposed to a CDK4/6 inhibitor. And that's where we use them in ESR1 mutation setting. This is focusing on patients who've had 1 to 2 lines of endocrine therapy, but not a CDK4/6 inhibitor. And those patients still exist, believe it or not, in the US and definitely way more outside of the US. And we want to understand what would be the activity of elacestrant in those scenarios where you will still have an endocrine option that is CDK4/6 naive, but we could see what the oral SERD would be like. So that's the ELSIN study. More importantly, we're also trying to study these agents for early stage breast cancer. So certainly we know in the metastatic setting, we have approval. We're going to use them for ESR1 mutant tumors, but can we actually improve outcomes in early stage? We know 50% of our early stage patients do not finish 5 years of intended therapy. Forget 10 years of extended therapy. They have toxicity issues. They have non-adherence issues. Because these drugs are well tolerated, because they are oral, we want to really see, can we actually delay ESR1 mutations, for example? Can we actually make our patients be adherent to these and improve the compliance rates and thus impact outcomes in early stage is really the basis of studying them in early stage. There are two ways we're trying to study them. One is we're trying to use the switch strategy, meaning patients who've already begun standard of care, aromatase inhibitors or tamoxifen, for 2 years at least and no more than 5 years, we're trying to see, can we capture those patients and then randomize them to a novel agent versus continuing the standard of care endocrine therapy? And that approach is being utilized in the EMBER-4 trial with imlunestrant, with Cambria-1, with camizestrant, and with the ELEGANT trial with elacestrant. So all three are looking at that switch strategy in high-risk patients or patients who finished at least 2 years, no more than 5 years of adjuvant therapy. Cambria-2 is also looking at upfront strategy for a high-risk patient population. So this patient could be taking a CDK4/6 inhibitor as well and would be eligible for Cambria-2. They're upfront trying to randomize these patients with an oral SERD compared to standard of care endocrine therapy with or without a CDK4/6. The Lidera trial, which has completed its accrual, was also this upfront strategy, but this did not allow CDK4/6 inhibitor because I think when it was designed, CDK4/6 inhibitors in the adjuvant setting were not really utilized. But again, there is an upfront strategy and a switch strategy, and we'll eagerly await to see how these novel agents can improve outcomes there.
Any situations right now where if you could, you'd use an oral SERD in the adjuvant setting, maybe a patient who is having a really hard time, cannot tolerate an AI, and you find that they've got ESR1 mutation but no clinical evidence of disease? Do you ever use cell-free DNA in that situation?
So I think, you know, one is that we don't necessarily think that the ESR1 mutation rate is that high in the early stage setting. But as I was saying, I don't think in the early stage we are relying so much only for ESR1 mutations. And yes, we've not been able to show superiority in wild type in metastatic setting, but that's a very complex setting, I think. Early stage is a slightly different case, and we're just trying to see if a better endocrine agent can be shown to be superior than our standard of care agent. Can I use that currently regardless of ESR1 mutation? I would be tempted to try, but I don't know if I'm going to get approval at all to be able to do that because we just don't have any data yet. But I'm hoping very soon we should start seeing these data in a couple of years, and hopefully we might be able to change that scenario because, yes, compliance is such a big deal. And if these patients can stay on these therapies and can tolerate them better, I would love to offer these to our patients.
We conclude with part two of one of our favorite related review articles on endocrine therapy of breast cancer from Lloyd et al. In Nature Reviews Clinical Oncology. And I asked Dr. Jhaveri to comment on the discussion and graphics in the paper related to the rapidly emerging concept of biomarker-directed endocrine treatment.
When we think about treatment selection, we have really landed in a position where we're choosing these therapies based on the biomarker status information that we obtain from the tumors. And so predominantly for, you know, a tumor that has already seen a CDK4/6 inhibitor in the first line. We certainly spoke about inavolisib, and that is now available in the first line for a PIK3CA mutated tumor. But for majority of the instances and for majority of our patients, our first line therapy is a CDK4/6 inhibitor with an aromatase inhibitor. And upon progression, we're thinking about what treatment to assign based on what have we learned from their tumor information, their genomic makeup. So if you have an ESR1 mutant tumor, We now have approval for elacestrant and hopefully soon with imlunestrant. For a PIK3CA mutant tumor, we have two choices. We have capivasertib. We also have alpelisib, a PI3K inhibitor. And we said the triplet in the first line for an endocrine resistant tumor. For an AKT or PTEN altered tumor, we have capivasertib again with fulvestrant. For germline BRCA carriers, we have PARP inhibitors. Very soon, we hope to have a label for somatic BRCA mutations. You utilize PARP inhibitors in that setting as well. So I think this is just trying to tell us that this is a way we guide treatment selection for our patients based on what we have learned about that genomic information. And if we don't have any targetable alteration, we still can utilize continuing a CDK4/6 inhibitor. We now have two data sets with abemaciclib in that case. We can use, you know, everolimus, which we have been using regardless of a PI3K mutation status information. And certainly we have approvals for rarer occasions, but still impactful, such as high tumor mutational burden and pembrolizumab or NTRK fusions and NTRK inhibitors. So this is just trying to tell us we went from having a simple ER-positive tumor where we would only offer anti-estrogen therapies and then think about chemotherapy to now a world of targeted therapies, which is really based on biomarker information.